And our guest today is Lenny Brenner, who is the author of Zionism in the Age of the Dictators, also The Iron Wall, Zionist Revisionism from Jabotinsky to Shamir, and 51 Documents, which is a collection of original sources on Zionist collaboration with the Nazis. So got a lot to talk about. Lenny, are you there?
Hi.
Hey, welcome to KABU.
Okay.
Well, let's start with you read about it a lot back in the 1800s, the Jewish question, and they call it that. Just exactly what was the Jewish question?
Oh, well,
can we sum it up or what?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Jewish question had different meanings in different countries.
Mm-hmm.
So give me a date. And I mean, just pick a date that you think is a good one to discuss, and then I'll give you an example of what I mean.
Well, I was sort of interested in what the Zionist take on the Jewish question was.
No, but I'm saying give me a date for the Jew that you want. You know, this discussion of the Jewish question.
Say around 1880, for example.
Okay, all right. Let's correct it. Let's say 1897 that's the founding conference of the World Zionist Organization, so
right.
on and so forth, all that good stuff. 1897.
Okay.
What had simply happened was that by that time, you had the American Revolution, which produced the secular republic. It had repercussions in France with a whole series of revolutions finally culminating in a more or less secular republic in 70, 71, etc. Then you had the whole question of Jews getting the vote in Britain in that period, and finally the role of the Jews in Kaiser Germany. Now, let's use that as a good one, and also the role of the Jews in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, because Herzl, the founder of Zionism, modern Zionism, was from Hungary, and he became a Viennese journalist, and he went to Paris for the trial of Albert Dreyfus, the Jew who was accused of being a spy for Kaiser Germany. Okay, the ultimate Jewish, caricature of the Jewish conspiracy is that Albert Dreyfus was accused of being a German agent. At any rate, and then of course the major thing was the Tsarist Empire, which had a huge number of Jews. My family came from Poland in 1913 on my mother's side, etc. And what you had basically was that in Europe, with the collapse of the Roman Empire, what we call the Middle Ages, you had the Jews of Europe were the merchant, what I would define as the merchant caste. In other words, their religion permitted lending, usury, credit, whatever you want to call it, and they were spread all over the known world. So they were the ones who brought diamonds, let's say, from India, which is literally where most of the diamonds came from in the Middle Ages. They brought them slowly into Europe, where ultimately they became a ring on some nobleman's finger and so on and so forth. But as the economies of Europe began to recover from the collapse of the Roman Empire and the barbarians, etc., eventually some of these countries began to say, hey, we don't really need the Jews as the merchant caste. We got our own merchants and so on and so forth. So there was persecution of the Jews. It went back and forth and so on and so forth. Then certain regimes like the Dutch and ultimately the British saw themselves as using the Jews, say, in the Caribbean, where Jews were among the very first slaveholders and so on and so forth. So, as I say, you have this enormous penetration. Jewish question arose with the rise of capitalism, where you no longer had the need for a merchant caste. It was, and the question was, what what was going to be the role of the Jews in the modern capitalist economy. And it lay there really, as I say, where the question of the Jews became more and more of a question for non-Jews was the great Jewish migration out of Tsarist Russia. Like I say, my parents and all those people, millions of Jews came out of there. Most of the Jews in the United States are descendants of people who came out of the Tsarist Empire. So Zionism was one answer among many, and it was really like a minor and insignificant element as long as America had wide open doors for white immigrants. But that came to an end in 1921 with, you know, the immigration laws, which specifically discriminated against Jews and Catholics. When I say specifically, it wasn't in the law, but it was designed to keep out the threats to white Protestant America. So there you go. And that tells you what the Jewish question is about. As I say, you're talking about 10 different Jewish questions, as I say.
Okay. Well, one of them now didn't, for most Jews, the answer was that, you know, they should be part of whatever country they live in, that they are citizens, you know, that they would be citizens,
right,
in a kind of a democratic, secular nation. They would, you know, they would have their role there. But the Zionists had a very different take on it, didn't they?
Yes. You know, like you had many, many Jews involved in the Marxist movements, the different Marxist movements in the Tsarist Empire. Some were Bolsheviks, some were Mensheviks, some were followers of a group called the Bund, which was you had to be a Yiddish-speaking Jew in Poland to be part of the Bund, and so on and so forth. And then others, rather than sit around and wait for socialism in the Tsarist Empire, they emigrated to the United States, and they were a big component part of the labor movement here, particularly in the garment industry here in New York, which was overwhelmingly Jewish, both the owners and the workers. My grandfather was a fur worker. He sewed furs together to make fur coats and stuff like that, as a worker, not as an owner of a store or something like that. So Zionism was looked upon in those days as a kind of a leftover. In other words, the Jews were trying to get involved in a secular society in Russia and Poland, or going to America and Argentina and so on, get involved in secular societies there. Now, there's another very interesting fact that most people, including specialists and Zionists, are unaware of. I caught it by accident. One of the interesting things about Zionism is that the founding fathers of the State of Israel, the founding father of the State of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, who was a labor Zionist, was an atheist. And this surprises people, you know, because one of the first things that he did when he established the state was had it declared an Orthodox Jewish state. And, you know, this came as a surprise to everybody. Both how did Zionism get led by an atheist, and how did the atheist wind up picking, you know, creating an Orthodox Jewish state?
Mm-hmm.
And someone dug up the fact that most of the Zionists, early Zionists, almost all of the early Zionists, were middle-class Jewish kids originally. The typical Jewish working-class kid in, let's say, Warsaw, he got bar mitzvahed at 13. You know, that's when you'll become a man, a mensch, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then he went to work. So he spoke Yiddish, and Hebrew was something that he either prayed in or stopped praying in, if you know what I mean. But he really didn't know it. It was like a Catholic going to a mass in the old days. The prayers were in Latin. He kind of knew what the prayers were about, but he really didn't speak Latin. But the middle class kids, their parents could afford to keep them in these Jewish yeshivas or schools after they were 13. Now, since these kids could read and write, et cetera, and they were, you know, and the societies around them are very secular, were increasingly secular and scientific, et cetera, a lot of these middle class Jewish kids also became atheists, but they could speak Hebrew, modern Hebrew, and, you know, medieval Hebrew plus the modern Hebrew that was invented by the Zionists, which was a sort of a modernization of medieval Hebrew, make it work, and, you know, including modern words and all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. So the result was that you had this, the Zionist movement, including its labor wing, was overwhelmingly middle class. Whatever they call themselves, they were overwhelmingly middle class, but they differed from the overwhelming majority of working class Jews in that they could actually, the idea of a Jewish state speaking Hebrew made sense to them, whereas to a Jewish worker in Warsaw, his attitude was, why should I go to Palestine where they want me to speak Hebrew, which I don't speak, and there's no work for me there? Let me go to New York, where I got a cousin in New York. You know, that was the mentality, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So Zionism was kind of looked upon as a contradictory eccentricity, a distinct minority in the Jewish community. From about 1900 to right up to right after World War II, the dominant elements in the Jewish labor movement here in the United States, which is huge, you know, hundreds of thousands of workers and so on, was either the Social Democratic Party or then the Communist Party.
Well, I know the Fur Workers Union is a very radical union.
Yeah, they were
Back in the days of Herb Gold?
Yeah, they were actually, well, now, the fur workers, to my knowledge, were, let me be sure about this, I think they were the only ones run by a Zionist. Hmm. The garment workers, International Ladies Garment Workers, was run by Social Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
The fur workers might have been run by either communists or Zionists. I know there was only one union that was run by the Hatters. The Hatters were run by Zionists,
mm-hmm.
but the fur workers were run by communists,
right.
as I believe is the story.
Right. Well, you know, in your book, Zionism in the Age of the Dictators, a very interesting part about, you know, the early Zionists had this idea of blood and soil, Blut und Boden, you know,
yeah.
which is kind of, tell us about that a little bit.
Well, you know, if you look at where, if you try to place Zionism in its context, what it does, it arises among the Jews at a point where blood and soil, in, you know, is becoming more and more of an issue all over Europe. In other words, you have German nationalism arising out of German feudalism. A lot of Germans wanted the unification of Germany and Austria. Hitler was only one who wanted that. I mean, there were a lot of them who wanted that. In Poland, you had a whole development of Polish nationalism, which had to define itself in terms of the Jewish merchant class and capitalist class. Jews were 10% of Poland. 10%. I mean, there were only 2% of the United States. There were 10% of Poland. And up until the late 19th century, they were the merchants, from big from little, from the guy with the push cart in the village to the big store in Warsaw, you know, that kind of thing. Zionism grew, and everybody was beginning to talk about race because you had the spread of colonies, white Europeans and white Americans running Africa, pieces of Asia, and so on and so forth. So inevitably, that's developed inside the Zionist movement. And if you give me a second, I'll give you a quote that really tells you how, just how deep it got. Okay, yeah, okay, here we go. I'm going to read you a little bit of Zionist racism, but I'm not going to tell you who it was until after instead of before to make it more of a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is a quote from a world-famous Zionist. I'll give you the date. 1921, all right? Nations with racial differences appear to have instincts which work against their fusion. The assimilation of the Jews to the European nations among whom they live, in language, in customs, and to some extent even in the forms of religious organization, could not eradicate the feeling of a lack of kinship between them and those among whom they live. In the last resort, this instinctive feeling of lack of kinship is referable to the law of conservation of energy. For this reason, it cannot be eradicated by any amount of well-meant pressure. Nationalities do not want to be fused. They want to each go their own ways. A state of peace can be brought about only if they mutually tolerate and respect one another. Now that, which is all about how nations don't want to get married to, you know, people from different nationalities don't want to get married to each other, all because of the law of conservation of energy, was by none other than Albert Einstein.
Mm.
All right?
Mm.
And what he was reflecting there, as Einstein hopped back and crossed the border from Germany to Switzerland and Switzerland to Germany in those days, etc. But he was essentially a product of the German cultural world, which was just full of all this separateness of ethnicities, etc. And he, this business about the law of conservation of energy is a fantasy. There is no law of conservation of energy in sex. On the contrary, more energy is wasted.
Okay.
In sex, if you get my point, you
mm-hmm.
know, it's just fantasy. But it shows you how deep that kind of, you know, ethnic identity, and you know, it's just full of that. Now, another example of the racial ethnicity business of Zionism. I'm going to read you something here. I will tell you who it is before I read it. But this is from the period of the Ethiopian War, which was a prelude to World War II, as you know, when Mussolini invaded Ethiopia. And this is an interview with Dr. Wolfgang von Weizsel, okay, who was, in spite of the German name, he was a Jew. And he was the treasurer of the Zionist revisionist movement. Now, you call the guy Vladimir Jabotinsky before, but the correct pronunciation is Vladimir Jabotinsky.
Okay.
All right. I mean, I'll let you live this time. But yeah. All right. At any rate, Jabotinsky's movement was called the Zionist revisionists. Now, what they were trying to revise was that in 1921, the British decided that they had given too much territory to the Zionists under the Balfour Declaration and the League of Nations mandate. The original so-called Jewish national home was going to be all of Palestine and all of what we now call Jordan. But by 1921, they realized this was ridiculous. There were no Jews on the other side of the Jordan River in what we call Jordan. And besides, they needed Jordan for one of their allies, the Sharif of Mecca, who had been overthrown by Ibn Saud.
Well, he was the one that Colonel Lawrence promised freedom to, right?
Right, okay. Right. But what happened was in all of that business, he got overthrown by Ibn Saud. So the British, to compensate him for that, gave him Jordan.
Okay.
But at any rate, the Jabotinsky took a position of, we have to demand back Jordan, because if the British gave us Jordan and then took it away from us, that will and we let them get away with that. That will inspire the Arabs. That will they will say, today we fight for an inch, then tomorrow we get the mile. You know, that kind of thing. So you always have to fight back against giving up what you got. Which makes Zionist revisionism very militaristic and very, very, hit them before they hit you kind of thing. But at any rate, in 1936, Wolfgang von Weizsel was interviewed by a newspaper called, a magazine called World Jewry, which is a Jewish community newspaper in London in June 12, 1936. And this is a quote from them. The French newspaper in Bucharest, Le Moment, has published an interview with the revisionist leader, Dr. von Weizsel. And then it goes on, quote, he personally was a supporter of fascism, and he rejoiced at the victory of fascist Italy in Abyssinia as a triumph of the white races against the black. Now, what that story was all about was that Jabotinsky never called himself a fascist. He was very particular about that. His movement attracted people who did call themselves fascists, including, as I say, the financial director of it, von Weizsel. Now, Jabotinsky's quarrel with fascism was over a fine point. Jabotinsky, was one of the world's leading linguists, and he had lived in pre-Mussolini Italy for 3 years and was so fluent in Italian that Italians couldn't believe that he wasn't an Italian. I mean, you know, he was that perfect. And he loved the country, and he resented it when Mussolini took it over. He found nothing wrong with their old regime. So he had a little quarrel about. And he didn't like the idea, you know, the Zionist movement was a democratic movement. I mean, it had regular conferences, just like any other movement in Europe at that time. So he quarreled with the doctrine of fascism. Also, as a nationalist, he couldn't get himself to say that he was a follower of an ideology from some other nationality. That was his quibble. But slowly but surely, he began to realize that the British were not about to give any kind of Palestine, a piece of Palestine, to the Zionists, because that would create problems for the British with the Arabs. So he began to shift towards Mussolini, and Mussolini, in appreciation of that, set up a Zionist revisionist youth group at Mussolini's Naval Academy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and what this led to was of course Zionism was completely legal in Italy at that time. For Italians. Okay, and let me read from what the Zionist revisionists themselves said about this Naval Academy. Okay, now this is from their own newspaper in Italian, La Idea Sionistica, from March 1936. And I'm just quoting some of the key points in it. The rabbi's benediction, quote, the order, attention, a triple chant was ordered by the squad's commanding officer. Viva l'Italia, viva il re, viva il duce, resounded followed by the benediction, which the Rabbi Aldo Latte is invoked in Italian and in Hebrew for God, for the King, and Il Duce. Okay, Giovenezza was sung with much enthusiasm by the Betarim, some still somewhat awkward with the Italian language. Now, what that is Viva Il Duce means long live the leader. That
right.
Duce is
what, you know, I think we're at the end of our half. I wish we had a lot more time to go into this.
Well, you can call me another time.
I think we will do that. I'm going to. There's so much to talk about here and in this history. But anyway, we're going to have to end for now. We've been talking with Lenny Brenner, who is the author of Zionism in the Age of the Dictators, The Iron Wall, and 51 Documents, among other books. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.